Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning and welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. Dermot MacDonald with you this morning. Our panel have been busy poring over this morning's papers, but before I introduce you to them, let's see what is making the headlines on this St Patrick's Day Eve. There is wall-to-wall coverage of last week's meeting between Taoiseach Micheál Martin and US President Donald Trump in the Oval Office. Let Trump address the Houses of Oireachtas is the lead for the Irish Mail on Sunday. Group political editor John Lee interviewed the to Simon Harris yesterday in Philadelphia, and Mr. Harris said it would be mutually beneficial that the full state honours be bestowed on the President Donald Trump when he visits Ireland. The honour has been extended, the paper notes, to four of his predecessors. A turbulent year ahead, says IDA chair as threat of tariffs looms. That's the main story in the Sunday Independent, which also carries a front page image of members of the Burke family who gate crashed the Ireland Funds gala dinner in Washington DC last week. The paper also carries a front page interview with Fred Phelps Jr. He's the pastor of the infamous Westboro Baptist Church in America, who said that the Irish Christian evangelicals should not have interrupted the gala. If they weren't invited, then they shouldn't have been there. That's trespassing, said Mr. Phelps. For the Sunday Times, the main story is Trump will not risk Good Friday deal in UK talks. And that's according to former US Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who insists that protecting the Good Friday Agreement would be a hardline issue for both Democrats and Republicans in any US-UK trade negotiations. Revealed, Martin given stark warning in private DC meeting. That's the lead for the Business Post. Conal Thomas and Sarah Collins report on a behind-closed-door gathering which heard of the need to axe red tape to protect the Irish economy. Well, having gone to town yesterday on the Burke family's invasion of the Ireland Funds gala dinner, the tabloids have moved on from DC and from Oval Office antics. Pill 16 is the splash for the Sunday World in a report labelled as an exclusive. Patrick O'Connell reports that Dublin GAA star Lee Gannon appeared in court after he admitted having the party drug MDMA at the Electric Picnic Festival. The 25-year-old, who appeared in court under his Irish name, Lee McFiona, was spared a conviction and the charge was struck out after he made a €300 payment to the court poor box. Help us get closure for Kelly is the lead for the Irish Sunday Mirror, which reports that Gardaí have launched a new appeal over the death of Kelly Lynch, a young woman found in a canal in Monaghan on St Patrick's Day last year. The Irish Sun on Sunday reports that gangland criminal Martin Foley, who owes €1 million to the Criminal Assets Bureau, may make a life for himself along the border. And the Daily Star Sunday reports that UK pubs are drafting in extra supplies of Guinness as revellers celebrate St Patrick's Day there. Across the Irish Sea, most of the newspapers in the UK this morning are reporting that there may be some backtracking on planned welfare cuts, including two disability payments, to help stave off a wider public rebellion. Well, joining me this morning to discuss all of the newspaper coverage is Lucinda Crichton, CEO of Vulcan Consulting and, of course, a former Minister for European Affairs. Siobhan Fenton, former Deputy Head of Press for Sinn Féin. Daniel Murray, Policy Editor at the Business Post. And Scott Lucas, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. You're all very, very welcome.
Thanks, Dermot.
You were a bit slow to answer there, Lucinda, and I was just wondering, is that because the jet lag from having been in the States all week has hit you? You're just back?
Yeah, I got back yesterday morning and I took something I bought at the airport called Dream Juice on the way home. So there might have been a bit of melatonin in that. So I had a reasonable sleep. So I'm okay. Thank you.
What was the mood like there this week?
I have to say, I mean, obviously there was a lot of apprehension. I started the week in New York. I went to the Ireland Inc. event at the New York Stock Exchange and had some roundtables there. And I came from New York fairly optimistic, even though the New York Stock Exchange was not in great shape.
But a chassis this week.
But a lot of positivity about Ireland, which is of course what we want to hear. And then in Washington, I mean, there was just so much going on. There were so many business events. We had all of the government state agencies, all of the big US Irish investors in the US and vice versa participating in American Chamber of Commerce, US Chamber of Commerce, IBEC, various other events all through the week.
Because it's not just the Bowl of Shamrock, it's our global annual global sort of trade.
Absolutely. And the vast majority of people there are nowhere near the Shamrock reception. You know, they're there for the business engagement and engagement obviously with representatives on Capitol Hill as well. And I had a lot of business meetings there myself on the margins, but it was really positive. You know, I think there was a fear that, you know, going from the sort of the highs of the sort of the relationship with the Biden administration, that it might be a little bit more strained, but actually it was very positive. And
did JD Vance, you know, we might think, oh, it's a bit twee, but did he sort of set the tone with the little kind of the gimmick of the Shamrock socks?
Oh yeah, I think so. And I think we knew that if that breakfast event with the vice president went well on Wednesday morning, then it probably would set the tone for the rest of the day. And that's exactly what happened. Yeah.
What was your thought? And there's so much coverage on it this morning, but what were your thoughts just on the Oval Office?
I thought it was hugely positive. Obviously, there was massive pressure on the Taoiseach to not mess it up, primarily. Now, I think anybody who knows Micheál Martin knew that he's a pretty steady pair of hands, you know, and he's a very, obviously a very experienced politician with longevity. But I think he ticked all the boxes. He delivered the messages. He obviously played to the Trump administration's priorities, which are all about the American economy, about, you know, domestic job creation, inward investment, etc. And he had some really good tales to tell about, you know, Ryanair and AerCap being, you know, the companies that buy most Boeing aircraft, which is, you know, you could just see.
It's sort of like sort of hitting the Trump bingo, you know, so you're hitting those things that will appeal to
him. That's what
he
needed to do, and obviously to sort of reiterate the deep ties between the two countries. And of course, I mean, the previous week, Trump had signed the declaration on the Irish Month of Heritage. And, you know, he spoke then about the big vote he gets from Irish America, which I think people in this country underestimate. Everybody here assumes, not everybody, but, you know, there is an assumption in Ireland that, you know, that Irish Americans will vote Democrat. They don't necessarily.
Because the profile obviously is changing. Scott, what did you think of it? What did you think of the reception? Obviously, the bar has been sort of, particularly after JD Vance and his attack on Zelensky, which sort of really, really changed the course of that particular meeting in the Oval Office. What did you think of how Micheál Martin did?
Oh, he's a professional. And the thing is that he's got professionals behind him. You know, the Irish Embassy in the United States, DFA, have been planning for months in terms of how they would handle this. They had put out the lines to the newspapers in advance that we were going to get Ryanair, we were going to get AerCap, Trump's golf course, yada, yada, yada. And when Trump threw, I think, the one grenade in that Trump will do. And by the way, J.D. Vance was squared away, and thanks to Lucinda for this, because there had been members of the DUP, Northern Ireland's DUP, who'd met Vance. So that helped diffuse him. Trump puts in the grenade about the pharmaceutical industry, and Micheál just simply kind of kicks it off to the side, comes back with, yes, but look at all the great investment we're doing. And then Trump,
it was sort of a reverse sort of, it was kind of, you know, praising the Irish in a way for managing to steal this, as he saw it, from the US.
There's a tell with Trump, which is once you deal with one of his points like that, and it happened with Keir Starmer last week with, you know, the invitation from King's Charles, he'll say, oh, yeah, but this is a tough negotiator. And he effectively said, oh, well, the Irish, you know, they're tough negotiators. And now I'm
Your
going to spend...
Your dad was a boxer and...
Yeah, I'm going to spend the rest of my time bashing the EU, right? But I think Lucinda's point that she's just made is important, is that there's a phrase in golf, which is you drive for show, you putt for dough. Mm. That was for show what happened. In terms of putting for dough, it was what happened behind the scenes. Mm. And I think the news cycle is going to be moving forward here today, which is you immediately come out of holding the line there into what is going to be Trump's tariff wars. And so there would have been all kinds of preparatory meetings behind the scenes, which is, look, if the EU is going to come back with these tariffs on April the 1st, including against, as we know, U.S. alcohol, is Trump going to retaliate? And I think all of that positioning is going to happen, was being done in private meetings this week. And of course, Ireland having to go back now to the EU over the next 2-3 weeks.
There's a really interesting piece Siobhan Fenton in the Sunday Independent this morning, where they got a body kind of expert analysis to look at the gestures that were kind of made by the two men throughout it, and looking at the weaknesses. It does seem like a kind of a Court of Versailles or some sort of the court of King Henry VIII, but these courtiers have to go forward and they're judged on how they deal before the king, how they cope before the king in his presence.
Absolutely, I thought that piece and the body language there was really fascinating. I think just seeing that dissection of how in real time Micheál Martin was trying to respond to what presumably was an incredibly high stress situation for him. As I say, it seems almost like, you know, a medieval king or a courtier or something, the fact that you have world leaders now almost kind of presenting themselves to Donald Trump and just having to almost, it seems like the bar is so low, it's subterranean at this point, that people are just trying to kind of escape from those encounters with as few ramifications for their own country and their own country's economy as possible. But I think it is a very bleak state of affairs in terms of how global politics is at the moment, that, you know, you can say that Micheál Martin came out of there with any significant wins for Ireland. It was more about just trying to get away without any damage. I think it just shows how volatile politics is globally, but particularly in terms of Donald Trump being in the White House, that is the best people can hope for, is almost just kind of keeping things, broadly speaking, the way that they are.
Yeah, and Daniel Moore, is it that it is just that, you know, that Plamas is now sort of success when you go in? If it was a reality TV series, you know, the Oval Office, you could always compete people or judge people on how they do, but before Donald Trump.
I think Donald Trump maybe sees it as something of a reality TV show himself, and he certainly sees what is now a regular occurrence, which is these lengthy rambling press conferences with world leaders, as something of a reality TV show himself. Speaking to the Taoiseach's people before they went over, there was great nervousness over that particular part of the encounter, mm-hmm. because they didn't even know how long it was going to go on for, and it really does seem to be at the behest of Donald Trump himself, and he went on for close to an hour, which is really a very long time for two world leaders to be sat in front of the media. And look, Donald Trump, for as complex as he is very simple in some ways. You know, he wants to be worshipped. And if you're willing to degrade yourself and go in and worship him, and Micheál was willing to do that, and it wasn't to everyone's taste, no. but it was something that he was willing to do, and to call him a peacemaker and to plumose him, you could almost see in real time how Donald Trump was wrestling with, well, I'm not happy with the Irish, but you're great guys, because this guy's just said nice things about me.
And you picked up on the kind of the behind the scenes meetings. Like, I mean, because obviously there's a certain choreography to this, and the meeting in the Oval Office is only one part of presumably a lot of shuttle diplomacy and drawing of lines that must go on beforehand.
There is, and it's for weeks in advance, really, that they're engaging and trying to figure out. But the problem is that you can do as much shuttle diplomacy with different parts of the administration, mm. and ultimately when you're sat in front of Trump, you're at the behest of whatever Trump says and does, and he is entirely unpredictable. And that's why I think the nervousness was all around that particular encounter. And you were talking about J.D. Vance setting the tone earlier on. We've seen how J.D. Vance is able to set the tone for many of these meetings now, and it certainly did help earlier in the day. That was another key point in the day. But then outside of that, it is engaging with the rest of his administration about really where the rubber hits the road, which includes the likes of tariffs. And it's one thing, the vibes in the Oval Office, and they were good this week, and that's the good news story out of this. But at the exact same time, the EU was launching reciprocal tariffs against the US. Donald Trump came out just the day after his meeting with Micheál Martin, said he was going to put 200% tariffs on alcohol, impacting in particular Ireland's whiskey industry. So, you know, vibes are one thing and actions are another thing altogether.
And can I just ask you, Lucinda, about that? Because whilst there is widespread praise for Micheál Martin, you know, right across the papers this morning, you know, people have been pointing out, and perhaps it's that age-old question that Mary Harney once posed about, are we closer to Boston or Berlin? And saying that in kind of letting a few things slide and his remarks in respect of the Apple ruling, you know, that obviously he was the first European leader to appear after Zelensky's catastrophic appearance in the Oval Office. Is there a sense of which team are you on, or as Matty McGrath would have said, who are you loyal to? You know, in terms
of... I met Matty in the White House, actually, now that you mentioned
it. You know, but just that sense of, well, wait a minute, you're part of this team, and you let a couple of things slide there, and on Apple, you know, he had made the point, well, you know, we supported them. So is there that sort of, that pressure in terms of where we pivot ourselves? Because obviously in respect of tariffs, that has to be negotiated at an EU level, but Trump likes dealing with individuals.
individuals.
I don't think that that's something that we needed to concern ourselves with this week. Okay,
this week.
Yeah, the EU. The trade and tariff issue will be negotiated directly between Washington and Brussels. And it is not a pretty picture at the moment, OK? And I know Maroš Šefčovič, the Commissioner for Trade, was there 2 weeks ago and had a pretty catastrophic engagement with his interlocutors in USTR, the trade arm of the administration, etc. And that is how it's going to go for the time being. I don't think that Ireland had any business, frankly, this week inserting itself into that hostile relationship. That would have been a really bad outcome and it would have been completely futile. Where there are a few opportunities now. Firstly, Trump effectively opened the door for ongoing closer dialogue between Dublin and Washington, and that can be of benefit to the European Union. We're a small player in the EU.
But does the EU get that we can sort of be that kind of much fabled gateway, that we can be there to kind of mind the American cousins or be their sort of the Trump whisperer, maybe in a sense, to because of that close relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very optimistic. I don't think that we have that much power or leverage, but we can certainly help to keep the channels of communication open, which I think is very important. I think there are a few factors here. I mean, one is we have an advantage being an Anglosphere country. We speak English and we consume an awful lot of American TV. And it's why our Irish people are so good at transatlantic business, because we get them. And, you know, in my own business, most of my clients are American trade associations or companies because they like actually dealing with Irish companies and interlocutors. And that's just the way it is. And it's good for Ireland. It's a disadvantage, I would say, at EU level. Many things, and we saw that with Zelensky, many things get lost in translation. And I think it's easier for Trump to relate to English speaking. And that's just a blunt fact. It's nobody's fault. It's just the way it is. So I think we can play a role there. But I think we need to brace ourselves. This is going to get very, very ugly before it gets better.
And I think one of the drinks producers this morning was saying, forget about tariffs at 200%. We're dead at 50%.
There's a lot of analysis has been done on this in recent months, particularly on the impact of tariffs. Like 5% tariffs, 10% tariffs can be passed on to consumers. 25% tariffs mean that over a period of time, you do start to look at your operations and you do start to probably relocate. And you go above 25%, and then it's very, very serious. But I would say this. The sort of tariffs that are being talked about at the moment, I mean, we've seen with Canada and Mexico, Colombia, for example, you know, he's trying to extract a price from all of them. And what have we got to play to our advantage at European level, including Ireland, everybody? One is he wants to sell a lot more LNG. And actually, LNG is a transition fuel.
So we should buy that
there needs to be a deal done, and there needs to be a contract contracts that he can promulgate to his domestic audience as a big victory. Likewise, in security and defence, we know that the European Union is going to be ramping up spending. They're going to front load the multi-annual financial framework, the 7-year budget. There's going to be EIB lending. There's going to be lending to member states. There's a huge opportunity there. Most of the hardware and most of the radar capacity, Ireland the cabinet has already decided to purchase a new radar system. So that's something.
So Trump is saying, ramp up your defence, ramp up your spending, and spend it with us. Scott, you've been looking at Alison O'Connor's piece.
Yeah, I think Alison navigates some of what Lucinda's been describing here, but says, look, the reality here is that Ireland, of course, you know, has, as it were, this relationship, this soft power relationship with the Americans. But when it comes to structures, Ireland is part of the EU. Mm. So here's, and I fully agree with this, here's the wider takeaway that I put to all of you.
She says, White House was fun, but EU is our home.
Yeah, which is what it is in reality. But here's the tension, and this is what could not be resolved by Micheál Martin in front of Trump, because you can't do it in public. And it would have to be in some of these meetings we're talking about in private. There are Trump administration officials who want to break the EU. It goes beyond tariffs. It goes beyond defense. They honestly just do not see the need for an EU. This was true in Trump 1.0 under Steve Bannon. It is true in Trump 2.0 in part because of J.D. Vance. And that needs to be recognized. Now, Ireland of course, did not publicly come back at Trump against him bashing the EU. But it's going to have to be said to the Americans and getting to the adults in the room, look, you need the EU. You cannot just simply deal with countries bilaterally. And that is going to have to be Ireland playing to those strengths, which is...
Can I ask you, Scott, because one of the things, you know, when you step back, because the US is incredibly powerful. It's financial might, it's military might, but it's got a 36 trillion euro debt, which is growing. It has promised over 4 trillion in tax cuts for taxpayers. And obviously it is trying to reorder the global financial system with tariffs and all of this. But how much might does it actually, what is the vulnerability of its own financial system? Obviously Trump doesn't care about the stock markets, but the bond markets are behind that.
Reality bites. And reality is going to bite the Trump administration because of this. You cannot finance that level of debt. And to put it into perspective, I just came back from 2 days of talks with investment firms in the UK. And they're looking at a fairly significant UK public debt. But they say, US has 5 times the population of the UK, but it's got 10 times the level of public debt. And it's going to go seriously up under the funding proposal that just went through Congress this past week. Now, what happens here is, first of all, you cannot have what the Federal Reserve was planning on the United States, which was a gradual decrease in interest rates when you're running this kind of debt. You're putting yourself as a possible hostage to fortune, including countries like China, who hold that bond debt.
But and the hedge funds.
And the hedge funds as well. And as you've seen with the volatility of the stock market, which is linked to what happens with bonds going up and down, you really have a race against time here. And that is that Trump and the unelected co-president, Elon Musk, wielding all this damage, including on America's economic agencies, and the economic figures that are already turning south in the U.S. And I'll just put this out here because there's kind of this myth that Trump is kind of like impermeable to this at this point. He's not. Since January 20th, his approval rating has gone only from 50% down to 48%. Or 47.5. Now, that's a slight drop. His disapproval rating is up from 41.5 to 49. That's in the space of 2 months. And that's before the economic damage really begins to kick
in. And that, along with the price of eggs, could prove pivotal. Can I ask you, Siobhan Fenton, just about the Sunday Times led with remarks by Nancy Pelosi that the Good Friday Agreement would be sort of a deal breaker for both Republicans and for Democrats in any US-UK trade talks. Do you think that was over-optimism on her behalf? The Irish America is very different now.
Yeah, it's very hard to tell at the moment. I think for so long within Irish politics, we've almost seen the Irish-American community as de facto being the Democratic kind of side of politics there. So it's very hard to know now that it seems to be if Irish-Americans are moving more towards the Republican politics, if there'll be that same kind of level of affection there and loyalty towards the Good Friday Agreement, which, of course, we saw during the Brexit negotiations was really pivotal, the fact that Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and other senior US politicians were willing to really stand up to Britain and say that, you know, the Good Friday Agreement has to be protected. And I think if it wasn't for those really strong links between Ireland and America, which have been kind of cultivated very carefully over many, many decades, you know, we wouldn't have seen that level of involvement.
But Daniel Murray, you know, there was a time when, you know, people like Richard Neal, Nancy Pelosi, they were in the ascendancy. Do you really think that this could be a deal breaker in the UK trade talks?
I'm not sure. I think that Keir Starmer is somebody who has stood over the Good Friday Agreement. And so we have somebody, at least in the UK government.
But also a committed unionist.
And a committed unionist. It really is a question, I think, of the impact of a possible US-UK trade deal on the North. And of course, what we've heard a lot in the aftermath of Brexit and the deal done between the EU and the UK is about diversionist standards and how that impacts on the North. And what could happen if there's a trade deal between the US and the UK? Well, there's a large diversion in standards in goods produced in the US and goods produced in the EU. And that could possibly become the pinch point at which goods begin to flow into the UK, into Northern Ireland. And then you have this issue of having to have a diversionist standard. So possibly that is where you would see that actually come through. I don't think there's anybody really who's looking to tear up the Good Friday Agreement over this, but there could be economic pressures coming.
I think it's fair to say as well that the likelihood of actually concluding a free trade agreement between the US and the UK is pretty much zero. There may be some particular deals done. But the idea of a comprehensive, there will be no comprehensive free trade agreements under a Trump administration. It's not possible.
Nancy Pelosi, we had her on the girl earlier this year, a very, very, very powerful woman, but the Democrats don't hold either house.
But this is a bipartisan thing. First of all, Lucinda's absolutely right. You know, and Daniel summarized the general situation. But there's going to be no U.S.-UK trade deal. It takes the U.S.-Canada trade deal the Canada-EU trade deal took, I think, 6 to 7 years to negotiate with a much smaller economy. Trump 1.0 talked about a U.S.-UK trade deal for 4 years and did zilch. So it's not going to happen here. And in terms of what happens in Congress, Nancy Pelosi, Richie Neal, but it's also not only other Democrats like Brendan Boyle, it's Republicans like Brian Fitzpatrick who are effectively saying, no, first and foremost, you have to safeguard the U.S. relationship with Ireland, both the North and the Republic. Then you can talk about what you're going to do on the economic side. We had the ripple with the Boris Johnson roadshow in 2019. Fortunately, he's gone. And so I think with respect, all this talk about U.S., U.K., Ireland, publicly you have to do what the Taoiseach said. But that's
and
not
of course,
the biggest issue.
Things changing with the very sort of predominant role that Keir Starmer is taking in a broader European context.
Keir Starmer, I think, is really interesting. So he's obviously, he's putting a huge amount of effort, for example, into artificial intelligence and the sort of the future technologies that are so going to be so pivotal to all of our economies. But he's not a big proponent of deregulation at all. And like the idea that the UK under Keir Starmer could align with the US regulatory standards on agriculture on a whole range of issues, it's just not going to happen. The other point just to make is that Hilary Benn, the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, was in Washington, D.C. all week. He was at everything. He was having meetings all over the place. So I think his interest and his commitment, and of course, he was chair of the Brexit committee in the House of Commons as well. I mean, he's a huge experienced parliamentarian and now minister, and he's not going to sort of sacrifice Northern Ireland either.
Daniel Murray, anyone who's ever been over to the absolute madness that is St. Patrick's Week in DC and all across the states, there's official meetings, there's private meetings, there's impromptu meetings. It's hectic for anyone who is involved in it. The Business Post is leading on a private meeting that Micheál Martin had in which he was being briefed that the EU needs to axe red tape, that needs to increase in competitiveness, and that is a huge message for Ireland as well.
It is, and this was the meeting of what's been called the Strategic Economic Advisory Council. It was announced to great fanfare a couple of weeks ago on the front page of our paper as well, and it's effectively a group of high-level US executives in Irish companies or with Irish links who can advise...
The likes of Stripe and others.
Now, the funny thing is we don't actually have details of who's
secret.
On it. It's been they're keeping their cards very close to their chest now, I understand.
But
a lot
of the messages echo what high profile Irish executives based in big US companies have themselves been saying, particularly about EU deregulation, GDPR. And I suppose that's the cultural differences between the two continents in many respects.
It is the cultural difference, but it's also something that's changing in Europe. We've had a number of reports now about European competitiveness, and we've seen the European Commission already to start to act on a range of basically deregulatory projects, not least of all a jettisoning of the corporate sustainability rules in recent weeks. So it's something that the EU is already moving on. But certainly this meeting with Micheál Martin, with these high-level executives, they were advising him on the threats around tariffs and trade wars with Trump. And they were effectively saying, you need to focus on what you can control. And that's back home, advocate at an EU level for less regulation, for more competitiveness.
And that seemed to be the post sort of DC messaging that was coming out of it.
Just a point on that, a really important point actually, is on how we prioritise our resources as a country. We're a small country, and I would argue that our permanent representation in Brussels, as well as our embassy in the United States in Washington, are the two most important locations for us to allocate resources at the moment. We are
in my view, critically, and I spent, obviously, I have an office in Brussels, I spent half my time in Brussels, we are critically under-resourced in both Brussels and Washington, D.C., and we need to address that. The government has an opportunity to basically put in place a new strategy now around this, because Ireland's voice is not heard sufficiently at EU level, not just because of our size, but because we're not as good at actually prioritising the European Union as others, like similar-sized member states.
We need to step up.
We're also
facing
something of a cliff edge with very senior Irish people in the Brussels bubble who are leaving, some of them very senior people that will be known, some of them more behind the scenes, and that's something that the Irish government have been warned about, and they're desperately trying to get
people who've got the right language skills there. Siobhan, before we go to the break, you are the former deputy head of press for Sinn Féin, so I want to ask you about the visit. Who was absent during it? So obviously Sinn Féin, SDLP and the Alliance parties all boycotted the White House this year. And Gabby Gadavkaitcha in the Sunday Independent saying the surprising winners last week were the DUP, who got untethered access to the US president and to others. And Simon Harris in that interview in Philadelphia was saying, I think he said, the Shinners choosing not to show up and the fact that it hadn't even registered with President Trump shows what we knew. It was a stunt. Did they get it wrong by not going to DC this year?
Well, I think there's no doubt about it that it was a very good week for the DP's Deputy First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly. I think the fact, you know, it's obviously it's a very kind of striking set of circumstances that you only have the DUP and the UUP over celebrating St. Patrick's Day and the Nationalist Party staying at home there. But I think to understand this was the reasoning behind why Sinn Féin boycotted that trip, it's more to do with kind of domestic politics, particularly in the North. I think one of the things that's kind of been missed, particularly in commentary within the South, is that I think a large part of that was there's been kind of increasing difficulties with how the party's positioning Michelle O'Neill as the First Minister, because I think as part of her being that kind of First Minister position, she's marketed as a First Minister for all, and she, largely speaking, kind of avoids any sort of controversies.
So it's a notable absence.
Yes, but I think for it will have played very well to Sinn Féin's base, particularly in the North, because it will have shown Michelle O'Neill, who I think is at risk of becoming a bit benign to a certain extent within Northern politics, because she's very rarely criticising the British government or other parties at the executive table, because she's been marketed as a First Minister for all. So it was seen as an opportunity to take a strong...
She is a First Minister for all.
Yes, but I think that was why I think the party is particularly keen to take opportunities to show Michelle taking a strong stance on international politics.
How well would it have played here? And I appreciate it. We're both from the same part of the world, so I appreciate it that it may well play to a domestic audience. But how do you think it will have played here? And they put some consideration into it. There are reports this morning that they consulted Lucinda, that they consulted Richard Neal, consulted one of the most significant Congress people. But do you think it backfired for them?
Well, the president was unaware of the boycott, so...
he knew about Rosie O'Donnell.
indeed. All I can say is I was at the Northern Ireland Bureau breakfast, which is one of the highlights of the week in Washington, D.C., and the only representative, political representative from Northern Ireland was the Deputy First Minister, Emma Pengelly, and she was phenomenal. I've seen her speak many times. It was definitely the best speech that I've seen her
give.
Especially
when the two women have been getting high praise for, you know, for working together in the, you know, in the interests of the office. Siobhan, do you think, you know, because they've lost the news agenda for a number of weeks, so do you think it was in hindsight a mistake, and should they have just rolled up their sleeves and whatever differences just to have been there and to have had a presence?
I don't think so at all. I think it would have been very short-sighted to have gone over just for the publicity for the week, because I think particularly for Sinn Féin's voting base, who obviously, you know, feel a deep affiliation with the people of Palestine at this time of ongoing genocide and the people of Gaza, it would have just been completely impossible for Mary Lee MacDonald to sell that to voters, to be seen to be, you know, I think it's one thing obviously maintaining ongoing high-level links about trade and politics with Washington, but another thing to be seen to be
her presence was reduced to sort of comments in a Chamber of Commerce brochure talking about the importance of trade. But Scott, Simon Harris said, you know, the easiest thing to do is to sit at home and take the day off. It's much harder to actually turn up, particularly turning up where there are points of disagreement and trying to navigate the way forward. But that's what politics is all about.
I think it has, personally, I think it has damaged Sinn Féin in the south, whatever about the domestic audience in the north. But I mean, Sinn Féin has struggled in the past 18 months to really project itself as a party of government. And I don't think this helps. I think that the whole challenge of government is inserting yourself into these difficult scenarios and actually coming out of it the other side, having delivered a message. And I think that's what Micheál Martin did. So I think it is, I mean, I'd be amazed if it hasn't really boosted Micheál Martin's personal profile domestically in Ireland, notwithstanding people's views on Gaza and the Middle East, etc., which everybody is aware of and the government has made its position very clear on. But I think in terms of, you know, I mean, what if Mary Lou MacDonald had been Taoiseach? You know, would she still
have
boycotted the White House?
What do you think, not being from the island, what do you think? What's the outsider's perspective?
I only as an outsider's perspective, there's a line from my favorite musical, Hamilton, about being in the room where it happened. And I don't think it's a case of, all right, you know, the Trump photo ops and all that. It's all those other meetings we've been talking about with congressional representatives, business representatives. And if you don't go over to Washington, you not only are not necessarily aware of everything that's happening in the room where it happened, you were being seen as being on the margins of this. And just think about it. If it had not, you know, instead of Nancy Pelosi having page one today about the need to bolster Good Friday Agreement, all of that, think about it. It had been Sinn Féin that had been able to make that statement. So I think it's with respect to Sinn Féin, it's a missed opportunity.
Sorry, Siobhan.
I think, though, it's always worth bearing in mind that, I mean, Sinn Féin is always looking ahead to the next election, you know, and I suppose if you're talking about, you know, what would Marley have done if she was Taoiseach, I think the general change within the party compared to the last Dáil term is, I think, they're just focusing on trying to win the election, you know, rather than kind of being seen too much as being a very moderate Taoiseach in waiting there. So I think, you know...
But Daniel Murray, they were left sort of tweeting about the line about housing, which is one of their strongest things, and that was kind of watching it on the live stream rather than being there and being able to have more authority.
It is.
And the election is far away at this point.
It is far away, but it is all in keeping with Sinn Féin's post-election strategy, which is not to try and be seen as a government in waiting anymore and straddle positions on a variety of different controversial issues, but to take very strong opposition positions to the government on a range of issues. And of course, Gaza is one of those issues. And don't forget, that is the reason that they said was for the boycott of the president. And that will have played very well with their own domestic base here. So it also keeps in line with the much more aggressive approach that they're taking in the Dáil to a range of issues. The Dáil speaking rights are out, and I'm sure we're going to see
rumbling on,
and we'll continue to rumble on next week. So it is in keeping with that strategy, I think, to be a populist party in opposition and not to try and be a government in waiting, which didn't work out for them last time.
There was me thinking, it's a bank holiday weekend, sure, what will we have to talk about? And we're nearly 40 minutes in, we better take a break. Welcome back. With me are, listen to Craig, Siobhan Fenton, Daniel Murray and Scott Lucas. Scott, I'm going to go to you just on Ukraine, Russia and now Yemen. Look, I mean, Steve Bannon was right when he said that Donald Trump would flood the zone when he came back for his second term. But just even looking at the UK papers this morning, Keir Starmer saying that Putin is delaying the ceasefire, calling for the guns to fall silent, and as Zelensky is warning that they're being encircled and preparing for another ground invasion.
Well, again, this is why it's important when they try to flood the zone to clean the walls off and say exactly where we are here. First of all, it's not the case that Russia is winning in Ukraine. Russia has made gradual advances in Ukraine, but against all odds, Ukraine pretty much is holding on to the largest share of territory that it's had since they had that existential crisis almost 3 years ago.
But under huge pressure in the process.
Oh, of course there's huge pressure. And what happened is that there was going to be, with pun intended, Putin's trump card was to get Trump into the White House because Russia is going to face economic pressure this year and trying to maintain what it's doing, et cetera. Where are we right now? Here's the key point. I think we focus so much on Trump, we miss what has happened in the last 2 weeks. Because of that ambush of Vladimir Zelensky, in particular by J.D. Vance, the European Union went almost onto an emergency basis because I was talking to people in Brussels on the Monday after that ambush, and they said, all right, this is it. We're stepping it up now. And let's track what's happened since then. One, Ursula von der Leyen, European Commission President, public and private capital with a target of 800 billion euros to go into defense industry, defense production, supported now by the historic decision in Germany to free up €1 trillion, which will include going in for defense production. Two, to provide some type of security guarantee that is not absolutely reliant on the Americans to protect facilities in Western Ukraine, including defense production plants.
And including, obviously, a coalition of the willing that would provide boots on the ground.
Exactly. And you'll notice that Keir Starmer, after the virtual meeting yesterday of not just European but other leaders, Canada and Australia, said on Thursday we moved to a meeting of the military leaders to talk about operational plans. Third, get the emphasis away from the direct U.S.-Russia talks, cutting out Ukraine in the EU, to get it onto talks which involve Europe and Ukraine. Now, where are we? There are now basically, the fundamental is, a Ukraine-U.S. proposal, which the EU helped engineer, which is for that 30-day ceasefire. So the ball's in the Kremlin's court. Secondly, commitments to increase the aid to Ukraine, which are not completely dependent on the Americans, even if you can't completely fill the gap. And third, some type of security guarantee now being discussed, not just as a matter of principle. So
Scott,
there is this commitment that has ramped up.
How significant is it that Trump and Putin haven't spoken directly? Obviously, he has hailed these good and very, very productive talks. He's had to do a bit of a shift in his team. So Kellogg is now just doing Ukraine. He got sidelined in the Russia talk. So, you know, what is the significance of that, that we haven't had this president to president?
The significance is this is Russia's leverage. It's really strange with Trump to say you hold something shiny in front of him. Keir Starmer went and gave him the shiny with the invitation to the state visit that came from King Charles. What's the shiny for the Russians? It's that phone call and then that meeting with Putin. Once they give Trump that call, when it actually happens, they've lost that leverage. It's already occurred. So they keep Trump just waiting and waiting for the call, which keeps him from completely committing, coming behind the Europeans, even as some members of his administration on the quiet are doing exactly that. The reason why Keith Kellogg, who you just mentioned, and this is important, he was supposed to be the envoy to Ukraine and Russia.
And Russia. And now he's been congratulated by Donald Trump for now just looking after Ukraine.
And why that happened is Keith Kellogg was one of the adults in the room after the bust up with Zelensky, who talked with the Europeans and the Ukrainians to get that social media post from Zelensky saying he welcomes the leadership of Trump that led to the ceasefire proposal.
So who needs who more, Putin or Trump?
Trump needs Putin for his ego. Putin needs Trump for any type of lasting success of what he hoped was his legacy, which is to conquer Ukraine.
So can I add just another element into the mix, because things happen very quickly in this new sort of world order that Trump is trying to reorient. Last night in Yemen, those very, very intensive military attacks by the US, looking at that axis of power, Iran, China, you know, Trump, what was the significance of those attacks last night?
Well, from the standpoint of Trump, it was just simply saying, even though he claims to be the peacemaker president, oh, look, I can order someone to bomb something. From the standpoint of around those people around Trump, it is to keep Iran on the defensive. Yemen's insurgents, the Houthis, who control much of the country, they have been attacking shipping in the Red Sea. This is all a spinoff from Israel and Gaza for some time. By hitting the Houthis, you send a message to the Iranians, which is we're keeping our eyes on you, even as Trump sends out chaotic signals. Because remember, Trump in the past week has effectively said, I would like a photo opportunity with Iran's leadership, and we're going to have a nuclear deal. But then also said, if I don't get that photo opportunity, then I'm going to unleash hell on them.
Lucinda, are we, I don't know, was it Winnie the Pooh who said, you're stronger than you think? Is the EU in any way in a stronger position than we think? There has been a lot of sort of shock and awe in recent weeks, and many people say Donald Trump is right. Europe needs to step up in terms of defence. We need to do all of that. But are we stronger than we think, just when you look at that, the geopolitics? Because the war is on the European continent.
So I mean, the Trump isn't wrong about everything. He was right in his first administration about the need for the European Union and Europe generally to spend more on its own security and defence. And he's right about that now. So that's clear. And actually, what we've seen is defence spending going down in Europe over the past two or three decades. Obviously, there's been a spike since the invasion of Ukraine. But actually, you know, Europe hasn't taken its own security and defence seriously. So, and on the world stage, if you don't have the capacity to defend yourself, you're not taken very seriously. That's just a fact. You know, you go to the Middle East, they're not really interested in what the European Union has to say. Obviously, in the US, particularly under the current administration, that's also the case. So you give others an upper hand when you don't have the capability to defend yourself and your citizens. And that has dawned on the European Union very, very quickly in the last 2 weeks. And that's why we've seen the sort of commitments. I think the most significant decision in the past week, we were talking about this before we came into studio, is the German decision to get rid of its debt brake. Like, recall, during
psychologically for them
during the financial crisis, I mean, when it looked like the euro could implode and the future of the European Union was even questioned, the Germans insisted on maintaining not only its own debt brake, but instilling in other member states, particularly the so-called pigs during that time, debt brakes of their own. Like, this is absolutely it's part of the German identity since the Second World War, and in the space of 24 hours it's gone. Well, it's unbelievable.
It's amazing, and the closer you are to those borders, the more acute
it just
is
shows this is existential. And I think there's a reasonably good appreciation of that in Irish circles amongst the Irish public. But it's not as existentially understood here as it is in Eastern Europe or in Germany and so on.
In any of those.
But it's just as important for us. And I've written about this repeatedly in my column in the Business Post. But I've written about it repeatedly. We are so exposed from an infrastructure point of view. And if there is a hybrid war, which, by the way, the chief of the German armed forces has predicted 2029, there will be a hybrid attack by Russia on Europe, on the European Union. Ireland is very much in the front line. We may not be in the front line for a ground war, but we are absolutely in the front line for a hybrid war.
Daniel, it could be even those sea cables. It could be anything.
It could. And don't forget, it was a Russian ship that was found lingering close to our gas pipelines. I'd say even more dangerous, to be honest, is the gas pipelines.
Yeah.
Because we have what are called a twinned pipeline, but it's effectively a singular piece of infrastructure that runs from around Drogheda across to Scotland. And if that goes, then aside from Corrib, we don't have any route for gas onto the island. The sea cables are certainly a threat, but I understand if one goes down, there is an ability to be able to accommodate through others. Now, you could go for multiple cables as well.
And my mind is activated after the Colin McCann's new book, so I'm all into the the cables at the minute. Can I ask you, Siobhan, that the increase in defence spending and, you know, the ask that is going to be in all European countries, how do you think that is being viewed or will be viewed at home? Do you think the more intense that activity becomes that we may have to step up as well?
Yes, I think that there's no denying that there's been a severe underspending in terms of defence for a very long time. I think in terms of investment, even in terms of rank and file members of the defence forces, often, and we talk about these kind of very large figures in the higher end of things, but I mean, you often hear stories of people who are members of the defence force who are sleeping in their cars because they can't afford to even kind of live near their barracks under the housing crisis from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. So I don't know how they then feel about whenever they're hearing these conversations around these very abstract kind of higher amounts there, whenever they feel like the investment isn't happening there for the kind of ordinary members. I think overall, though, it is concerning to see, if there is an increase in militarisation of European countries. Obviously, Ireland is a proudly militarily neutral country, and I don't think the people of Ireland would want that to ever be kind of watered down or diluted. But at the same time, there's no denying that the way Ireland kind of exists in the international stage, the military is completely, seems underprotected and underfunded.
And a core member too of the European Union. It's just coming up to just after 10 to 12. I'll take another quick break. With me this morning, Lucinda Creighton, Siobhan Fenton, Daniel Murray and Scott Lucas. Daniel, lots of stuff on infrastructure and all aspects of it, including housing this morning. But that whole question, whatever about counts or undercounts of housing, is that if we want to meet the housing goals that the government has set, we are going to need private capital and we are going to need the vultures.
Yeah, so this is Dan Murphy writing in the Business Post today after being at what I think is pronounced MIPIM, which is the biggest real
the
estate...
The big, down in Cannes. They go down for a week to...
Exactly, the big real estate investor international
conference. And we had a pavilion
conference.
At it this year.
Well, apparently for the first time we had a full delegation at it led by the Irish Strategic Investment Fund, the Government Sovereign Investment Fund. And we were there to send out the message that Ireland is open for business and it is looking for private capital from these big real estate investment funds, which have been given the
name
here.
Can we do it without that injection of private capital?
No, is the answer. The estimates are that it's going to cost about 20 billion a year to build 50,000 houses. I think the government is currently spending around 6 billion or so a year, and that's while the public finances are in rude health and it's able to afford that level of capital investment into the housing market. The rest has to be made up by private capital from a variety of different sources, but certainly these type of investors will be a very significant source. And that's where you get into and you begin to understand a lot of the controversial policies that have been touted in recent weeks when we hear about reforms to rent pressure zones. In particular, it's about creating certainty for these investors so that they're willing to invest in a way that they were willing to invest a number of years ago and that they have stopped investing in recent years.
And Lucinda, you know, we probably have a certain view of vultures, particularly after the crash and, you know, entire apartment blocks, you know, which are for rent, they can't be bought, and people perhaps have a negative view of them. But these private equity, these big funds, they don't like initiatives like rent pressure zones or anything. It deters them from placing their capital.
Yeah, I mean, I would take a slightly different view of the financial crisis. I mean, it was the investment funds that were pleaded with and begged with, begged to enter the market after the collapse of the housing system in Ireland, around about from sort of 2008-09 on, and there were particular incentives put in place by Michael Noonan and the government that I was part of at the time to get them to come in to fill the gap
because and they fill a role.
They fill a really important role. Obviously, it became very politically controversial, particularly sort of two governments ago. And I think kudos to Sinn Féin for sort of coining these phrases, vulture funds, cuckoo funds, etc. I mean, what they are investment funds and we need them. So you don't have to like them. You don't have to sign up to the ideology. But I think a big mistake was that actually Fianna Fáil, particularly in opposition, sort of signed up to that narrative and adopted it and propagated it. And so when they went into government, they then sort of had to put in place some of these policies. So for example, they messed around with stamp duty, and you need certainty for investment funds. They go all over the world. They can go anywhere. If you look at Germany, which has a very stable housing market, there's a huge investment a history of investment, particularly from pension funds in Germany, and it has actually stabilised the market to a large extent in most parts, not all parts, but most parts of Germany. And you also have long-term leasing and renting, which we don't really have a culture of in Ireland, but I think we will have to get with the programme, because when you have so much pressure on a society, and I know people were angered about the sort of throwaway remark by Donald Trump during the week about, well, that's sort of the price you pay for success. But of course, that's fact. You know, if you have a booming economy and you have an influx of talent into the country, then of course, and add to that the fact that we opened up our doors and our borders to a huge number of Ukrainian refugees, which I support and was the right thing to do. But with all of that, you know, including the success of the economy, of course you're going to have huge pressure on housing. That's a fact. But you have to try to use all tools available to solve it and to make housing available. And I really don't think that people care where their home comes from, whether it's been funded by an Irish bank or a US investment fund, so long as the house is available. And we've actually seen a reduction in availability of housing this year, which is crazy.
And Siobhan, Sinn Féin tried to make a lot about that comment, but we've actually actually heard from Micheál Martin before about that part of the housing crisis is due to our success. Do you think that it's just a reality that we need that capital investment from funds if we are to meet those targets?
Well, personally, I think we need to see public housing on public land, but at the same time, because the housing crisis is so severe and is causing, you know, so much misery for so many people, of course, you know, every possible solution should be looked at. I think with respect to Lucinda, I disagree with that comment around the fact of, you know, Ireland having a booming economy. I think a lot of people will be listening to that at home and thinking, you know, who is it booming for? And for so many people, that's very much, you know, not the case. I think one of the kind of backdrops of, we've seen, obviously, so many Irish ministers going around the world, you know, as part of this kind of St. Patrick's Day celebrations, because there's so many people have emigrated from Ireland. And obviously lots of people are emigrating, you know, with a heart and a half to, you know, go
well,
off with their lives.
Well, they've always, in fairness, gone anywhere they could.
Yes, but I think the kind of the backdrop to all of that is that, particularly for my generation, I'm in my early 30s, and so many people feel forced to emigrate because they don't see any kind of future or quality of life for themselves here in Ireland, largely because of the housing crisis. And so, you know, many people do feel forced to move to the States or to Australia.
Scott, this is your first St. Patrick's Day here. Look, I mean, what do you think, like, I mean, looking at the housing crisis here, it's not unique to Ireland, but it is definitely something that is pointed out by, whether it's investors or others, as being a real, real challenge for us.
Yeah, there's so much we could talk about because it's in every week. But I think
you could try and keep it to about 30 seconds.
Yeah, here you go. You want more houses. To get more houses, you either have to have public expenditure to build the houses, or you have to have private capital to build, or you have to have a mix. That's the starting point. You need to have planning around the mix that you're going to have while continuing to have protections. For example, those who are renters in the markets, that all of a sudden you don't have a complete deregulation of rents that puts them out. The question to me, to the government, I got two questions, is one, for next program, what can we learn from Germany and how they've done it? And two, can the government finally put all of this together rather than giving us a different press release for each week?
Well, we're going to leave it on that cliffhanger. Scott Lucas, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute of UCD, to Daniel Murray, Policy Editor at the Business Post, to Siobhan Fenton, former Deputy Head of Press for Sinn Féin, and Lucinda Creighton, CEO of Vulcan Consulting and former Minister for European Affairs.